Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. Whoa, who knows anything about Max? Not me. How do you get this to display? Oh, you're seeing it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to present to you some of the work I've been doing with a lot of colleagues, going a bit further than the electrical resistivity model. I mean, in my youth, I was enticed by conductivity until my very good colleague Alan Green told me that no one gives a rat's ass about electrical conductivity, they want to know about the Earth. And so the last few years, I've been trying to integrate conductivity measurements with other measurements. I'm going to show you where we're going with that, and particularly in an integrated framework. I'm hoping to appeal here to the younger members of the audience because I think this is the future, is an integrated approach. We heard in the last talk a very integrated method. There are some weaknesses with it which were explored in the questions, but still it's a step forward, and I'm going to show you some examples of that. Somewhat not younger members of the audience, perhaps in the words of Tuzo Wilson, a well-known architect of plate tectonics, he said, "I like disturbing scientists," so I hope I disturb some of you. The basic take-home message that I want you all to walk away from is that we have got to stop looking at one type of data and making conclusions about the Earth from that. There's every reason to believe, and we saw it quantified in the last talk, that changes in one data type are also commensurate with changes in other data types at the same time. And we have a lot of data that often we ignore, and topography is one of the most important ones. That's critically dependent on the lithosphere thickness. And we have geoid, we have heat flow almost everywhere. I'm going to show you an example of some work that was done in Ireland, and I only picked this because I'm based in Ireland, but I'm sure there's lots of examples around the rest of the world. And this is work done by some three seismologists, one of whom's in the audience. Sorry about this, Rocky. In which they made measurements across Ireland, and on the basis of an event they saw that reduced in depth from south to north, they interpreted lithospheric thickness in a S receiver function that was commensurate with a thinning LAB. So they observed this shear wave, this S wave receiver function interface that they interpreted as the LAB. And I'm going to use this nomenclature for a seismic LAB based on receiver functions. A dramatic thinning of the lithosphere from 85 kilometers in southern Ireland to 55 kilometers in northern Ireland. Is this reasonable? We have a lot of other data. We have heat flow, topography, gravity, geoid, MOHO, and MT, but I won't talk about all of these. Just to show you some of the geophysical observables, the topography, for those of you who've been to Ireland, you know Ireland's pretty damn flat. It's got almost no geoid, it's got no free air anomaly, it's got no boogie anomaly. There is the inference from some older work that there is a heat flow change from south to north, getting hotter to the north. And this was actually one of the key points that they held on. So 30 kilometers of lithospheric thinning, is that reasonable given these other data? And we're going to explore that. We're going to try and fit, in the first instance, just two data points. We're going to try and fit the topography. The average topography of Ireland is 60 meters, plus minus 20, and the average surface heat flow is 60 milliwatts per square meter. And we've heard how important the crustal structure is. Fortunately, it's very well defined in Ireland, and these are the crustal parameters. So let's model those, and we have to choose an oxide chemistry. And we can choose an oxide chemistry going from the most depleted to the most fertile. And the most depleted, fortunately, we have some mantle xenoliths from Northern Ireland, and that's the column on the left, labelled Inver, with a magnesium number of 90.7, to the most fertile that we could expect, primitive of a mantle. So let's put that crust on top of those mantles and see what sort of topographies and surface heat flows we should expect. So on the left column, you'll see lithospheric thickness. The next column gives you heat flow. So to satisfy the heat flow, we need a minimum thickness of about 80 kilometers. But then depending on the composition that you choose, if you choose a very depleted composition, of course, you'll get very thick lithosphere and the The lithosphere that you need to have for a very depleted composition is 115 kilometers. The lithosphere for a very fertile composition, as fertile as we can expect on Earth, is something like 90 to 95 kilometers. And so just in this very simple 1D test, we can say that the lithosphere beneath Ireland should lie between 95 to 120. In two dimensions, we can explore the suggestion that you've got rapid lithospheric thinning from something very depleted to the south to very very fertile to the north. And if we put this into the 2D code, we get a huge increase of heat flow in the top column, top row. We get a decrease in the Boogie anomaly of 100 milligals. We get a geode anomaly of 6 meters. And we get a topographic increase of almost a kilometer going from Southern Ireland to Northern Ireland. And we, you know, for those of you who've been to Northern Ireland, you know it's not a kilometer higher than Southern Ireland. We can, in fact, fit the data in a forward modeling sense by adjusting the layers. And in particular, we've put a layer boundary in that tries to explain the seismic observations so that you've got a chemical boundary at 85 kilometers to the south and 55 kilometers to the north. But we do need a lithosphere of about 90 kilometers minimum to about 110, 115 maximum. Maximum thinning is about 20 kilometers. And so in conclusion, I'm afraid those seismologists, by labeling their event, the LAB, they made a mistake. And this is what we geophysicists have to be very careful about, is when we label our events. We shouldn't do that. We should say we've seen a seismic event and it could be A, B, or C. So I'm going to spend quite a bit of my time in Southern Africa. This is a tectonic map of Southern Africa produced by Sue Webb. Of course, for South Africa, we have a lot of exposure. It's fairly well known. But for the rest of Africa, for Botswana and Namibia, there's a lot of sand cover, sedimentary cover. And so it's based on the magnetic anomaly map for the region. So just remember where the Curie isotherm lies. So this particular tectonic map is a crustal tectonic map. It's not lithospheric scale. In the 1995, 96, 97, there's a wonderful experiment performed by Carnegie, MIT, and people in South Africa, a component of which was a seismic experiment called the SASE, Southern African Seismic Experiment. I think this is fairly well known by now. When this experiment was going through the Continental Dynamics Panel of National Science Foundation for funding in 1995, the review panel wrote, "This is a wonderful experiment, you should add MT to it." And I know that because I wrote that sentence. And so a few years later, we applied for money to do our own experiment, and we got it, referring to the panel's report. This is a body wave tomographic model along the slice, northeast-southwest slice. These are quite well known, and Hans Thiebaud in particular has pointed out issues associated with body wave tomography. But let's look at it in a relative sense. These indicate very thick lithospheres that the petrologists have problems with. Of course, we have surface wave models as well, and these are much more consistent with the petrological information. So then we did our magnetotelluric experiment from 2004 to 2007, 2008, and we've got now something like 750 MT sites all over Southern Africa. And you can see the MT sites in the various dots. The black dots are the seismic sites. I'm not going to show you the data, of course, but I will show you some information that we can extract, approximate information, and then models. And this is a resistivity image. It's not a model, it's an image, taking the data and applying some techniques. And so the blues are very high resistive regions, reds are very conductive regions, and the outlines, the black outlines, are the outlines of the tectonic map of Southern Africa. And in the main, you can see the reasonable consistency between cratonic regions and the cratons, also cratonic regions and high resistivity regions, and mobile belts and low resistivity regions. The other thing that's plotted on that map are the three colored dots. The red dots are diamondiferous kimberlites. The green dots are non-diamondiferous kimberlites. And the white ones are unknown. That means unknown to me, in as much as somebody knows, but they're not telling me. Now, the point about diamondiferous kimberlites is we know that diamonds come up there. The graphite diamond stability field is at about 155 kilometres in southern Africa. If you've got diamonds, you've got to have a lithosphere that's roughly 175 kilometres or thicker. And so this is a real strong piece of information. These kimberlites vary in age, of course. The youngest being about 65 million years ago, but we know where those reds are. We have lithosphere that's 175 kilometres or thicker. Greens may or may not, but the implication is that you've got thinner lithosphere, thinner than about 150 kilometres. You've got to be careful. There's one particular dot here. This one, right on the border of Botswana, Namibia and South Africa. That one was actually brought in by the unscrupulous operators of the kimberlite to try and boost their stock. So that's known as a bicycle diamond. We can look at our data in many different ways, and the question arose of resistivity anisotropy, and we would expect the lower lithosphere to be much more anisotropic in its parameters, also the electrical parameters, and we see that generally we see higher anisotropy associated with the cratonic regions than with the non-cratonic regions, and quite high anisotropy associated with where the kimberlites, the diamondiferous kimberlites come up. We can calculate temperature, and here's a temperature map at 200 kilometres from our conductivity data. Of course, as you'd expect, we've got very low temperatures in the cratons and higher temperatures in the mobile belts. So let's now compare qualitatively the resistivity information with seismic information. And so the hit on the backdrop is the 200 kilometre resistivity map, and in front of that is the compressional wave map from Fouch et al, body wave map. Anything between plus minus 0.25 is transparent, and so you can see the high velocity regions in blue, the low velocity regions in red. And qualitatively, you see a very strong correlation between high resistivity and high velocity and low resistivity and low velocity. Can we quantify that? So let's do that by looking at two particular areas where we know quite a bit about the mantle. And the wonderful thing about working in southern Africa, particularly the Katma Craton, is that we have so much information, geochemical information. So let's look at these two kimberlite fields, Jagersfontein and Gibeon. And we'll take sample xenoliths from both of these. The one in red is called the FRB, is the acronym they use for Jagersfontein, and we list their magnesium number and the mineralogy, the pressure, temperature, and approximate depth, and the averages given in the bold. And the same for Gibeon. You can see that Gibeon is a lot hotter by over 100 degrees. So let's calculate what we'd expect. And the way we'll do this is something I published a few years ago, where we calculate from hash and Strickland bounds with variations on pressure, temperature, magnesium number, composition, and water, what you'd expect for the velocities and resistivities beneath that region. One thing to note is that velocity is essentially a function, or a linearly dependent function, on temperature, whereas that should say rho, not r, is an exponentially dependent function. So this is what we'd expect for the two. Jagersfontein, we should expect something like 4.65, and Gibeon something like 4.61. And we'd expect an average log resistivity of 5.2 for Jagersfontein and 4.36 for Gibeon. But what do we observe? Okay, and these observations come from Stuart Fishwick's seismic work and from our own MT work. The seismics correlates very well, 4.65, the observations 4.7. 4.61 compared to 4.51, although this is on the edge of the region. There's some averaging issues possibly reducing that number. However, we have a major difference between what we'd expect to see from dry mantle minerals and what we observe by two orders of magnitude. And what's that due to? Well, fortunately, Anne Peslier told you all about water. We have a huge amount of water in the matrix. And when we look at the effect of that, what I'm showing here is velocity 1 over log resistivity. It's 1 over log resistivity because it's exponentially a function of 1 over temperature. And so it's linear in velocity 1 over log resistivity space. And this is what you'd expect for dry conditions, going from Jagersfontein or Catbald Craton to Gibeon. And as you add water, you increase the resistivity by a huge amount. You don't affect the velocity at all at these low water contents. So how does that work in the field? So let's take a map of the resistivity at 100 kilometers. And this is it. And we'll take a map of the velocity from Stuart Fishwick at 100 kilometers. And that's that one. And we compare the two. And clearly, again, you qualitatively see blues where there's blues and reds where there's reds. But we'll quantify that now in terms of our velocity log resistivity space. And this is it. It's a bit of a complicated diagram. I'm going to show you this three times. What I want you to concentrate on for now is this green line, which is the regression fit using a robust least squares fit using the Fasano-Vio technique, where you assume errors in both components. And so here we have an equation with a correlation coefficient of 0.7 relating log resistivity to velocity. So if we know the resistivity, we can predict the velocity. How well does this work? So here's the actual velocity, and here's the predicted velocity using that equation. And you can see it works fairly well in most places, except some places where it doesn't. We know we've got introduction of conducting material in this region because of Bushveld magmatism. We know we've got lower velocity, resistivities here because you're on the mobile belt. This one we don't quite understand. The resistivity will predict higher velocities than observed, and we do need to spend a bit more work on that. Let's subtract those two maps from each other. Stuart tells me I should believe his work to plus minus 0.1 kilometer per second. So basically the white and the light colors. That's true of over 90% of southern Africa. Okay, so I can describe the velocity structure from resistivity for 90% of southern Africa, particularly the Craton regions. One thing you might have noticed, these squares here is a 2D histogram. So there's clearly some clustering that's occurred in this data. So we'll do a cluster analysis. And when you do a cluster analysis, the one thing you have to define is the minimum number of clusters using a Dunn statistic. And that tells me I need 5 clusters. Less than that, you get a poor fit. More than that, there's no statistical reason to add them. So here are the 5 clusters of those data. Let's project those 5 clusters now back onto southern Africa. And this is what we get. And what you see, it blew me away when I saw this, was that there's actually a tectonic correlation. We've got these black ones, which is a high velocity but variable resistivity. So you've got cold but variably wet Catbald Craton. Then you have the red ones, which are high velocity regions but low resistivity. So these are cold but very wet. We've got a lot of water in the olivine. And that's in central Botswana. You have the blue ones, which is the Angola Craton. Moderate velocity, but very low resistivity. So warmer, but very, I should say high resistivity, sorry. That should say very dry, which means depleted. The green ones, low velocity and very low resistivity, warm, very wet, so very fertile in the Rehoboth Craton. And then the purple ones, low velocity and moderate resistivity, in the Damara Belt, the Pan-African Damara Belt. And the final thing you can do is calculate the water content. So this is the dry conditions. And as you move to the right, what you're doing is introducing water. So all of these points represent water in the matrix. And let's plot that on a map. So here's a map of the water in olivine at 100 kilometers below southern Africa. And you can see, as we said before, Angolan Craton is very dry for most of its part. Catbald Craton is variably wet. Very wet regions associated here. Okay, let's do some more quantitative modeling now using that LITMOD approach. And in the Catbald Craton, just to remind you of the tectonic setting, Here we are looking, I'm going to show you a model going from Jagersfontein through Kimberley up onto the Rehoboth, and this is it. And particularly the Catbar Craton, we would get from this an electrical lithosphere about 220 kilometres. I won't go into the details. These were published in Javier Fourier's paper in 2011, but we know very well what the mineralogy is, or we know very well what the geotherm is, and we know this from the Group 1 and Group 2 kimberlites, and we can predict from those what we should expect from densities and water contents. And what we have to have, and fully consistent with what Anne Peslier told us earlier, is a dry lower lithosphere. What does seismology give us? Well, it's all over the map, I'm afraid to say. Here's some results from receiver functions published by three different groups who give three different depths to the LAB, from 150 kilometres to 260 kilometres. Now, anyone in the room that's ever bought a diamond ring knows that there's diamonds that come up from here. So the idea of suggesting that the lithosphere is only 160 kilometres below Southern Africa doesn't make any sense, petrologically. What do we get from surface wave studies? Well, they're kind of all over the map as well. Here's four different results. And you can pick what you like, essentially, from anything from very shallow, 120 kilometres, to much deeper. Let's try to do this now in a self-consistent way. And we're using for this some work that's just been published by Sergei Lebedev and Joanne Adam, who's in the audience, where we're looking at the variation across the Catbar Craton and trying to fit the seismic data, the MT data, the topography, and the heat flow. And of course, we've got to assume something about the chemistry of the mantle, but we know a lot of that from the xenoliths, okay? So here we are, we're doing some hypothesis testing. We have a topography of 1320, but consistent with some of the questions from Javier, this is a static code. And there could be something like up to 500 metres of dynamic uplift. So we want to look for results in this sort of range, 1320 to 820. We want to look in terms of heat flow for values in the range 38 plus minus 6 or 7. So these are the two acceptable regions. And when you put them together, this then gives you a coarse bound on how thick your lithosphere can be, from 160 kilometres minimum to around 230 kilometres maximum. Trying these different chemistries, if the lithosphere is made entirely of Hartzbergite, those two fields don't overlap at all. So here we have to play with different chemistries which are consistent with the petrological observations. And this three-layer one is the most consistent. Let's examine these two models in detail. This particular model of 160 kilometer LAB doesn't fit the seismic data and doesn't fit the MT data. When we choose the other model, 240 kilometers thick with this particular MG number and that chemistry, then we can fit the seismic data. We fit the MT data, we fit the surface heat flow, and we fit the topography. The intriguing thing is when we can construct from those data synthetic receiver functions, we find a very strong event that we can associate with the Hartzbergite to Lherzolite boundary. And we're suggesting that, in fact, this event is the one that's been picked up and mislabeled as the LAB. It's actually a mid-lithospheric discontinuity associated with a chemical boundary. Finally, example from southern and central Tibet. And here we're going to look at, in a broad sense, two regions. One is the Lhasa block and the Kwangtang terrain. And here, the data that we have MT data from representative sites. We have surface wave dispersion curves, again from Sergei and his student. We have heat flow and topography, and we're going to model it all. So if we model a Qingtang terrain, this is the MT, and there's the seismic data, we can model that with a lithospheric thickness of the order of 100 kilometers, a dry lithosphere 100 kilometers. When we try that same game for the... parameters for that. When we try the same game for the Lhasa terrain, however, here we're putting different lithospheric thicknesses that fit the seismic data. We cannot fit the magnetotelluric data for a dry lithosphere. We have to add water. So here we've added water. You can put the geometry in as you like, but you need to put water in the lithospheric mantle beneath the Lhasa terrain with a lithosphere of around 150 to 200 kilometers thickness. So in conclusion, I've tried to show you that seismology is primarily sensitive to pressure, temperature, and composition. Resistivity, electrical resistivity or conductivity, primarily sensitive to temperature and water content. Taken together, using the velocity to control the resistivity, we can get the water content. Topography significantly constrains lithospheric thickness. The height of the surface is a huge constraint on the acceptable thickness of the lithosphere below you. But you have got to have very good control on the crustal parameters. The variation that I showed you for island could be acceptable to plus minus 10 kilometers in lithospheric thickness. Lithospheric mantle appears to be wetter in its upper part and dry in its lowermost part, consistent with the observations reported to you earlier. And we clearly need to go to the Siberian Craton. Again, the take-home message, stop looking at only one type of data. You've got to work. The Earth is a single physiochemical system. And look at all the data that's available to you. And the best approach to use is one that models all the data in a thermodynamically self-consistent manner and is based on petrology and geophysics. Thank you.